Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, July 15th. Long-range missiles are coming to Hawaii. The U.S. Army at Schofield is acquiring the rockets as part of an initiative to boost its warfighting readiness. It's a first for Hawaii. So what does this mean for training in the islands? We hear about renewed talks between Hawaiian Electric and Huhonua after a previous deal got struck down by the Hawaii Supreme Court. We get the latest on another court ruling, this one affecting a controversial development on the Garden Isle. And we work your funny bone. We hear from a comedian who's performing on Maui this weekend. Plus, we hear from a principal dancer with the Carolina Ballet who returns home this summer and will be taking the stage with young students. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, the U.S. Army announced its plan to add long-range missiles to its arsenal here in Hawaii. In a media briefing that just wound up in the last hour, the military talked about the need to add the capacity of the high-mobility rocket launchers to strengthen its defenses here in the Indo-Pacific with the threat from China and Korea. Major General Marcus Evans, the 25th Infantry Commander at Schofield, said the move is part of the Army's Transformation Initiative, an effort to train troops to compete on a modern battlefield.
As part of that, we are integrating in high-mobility Army rocket systems, or the HIMARS. Really, what this means for the division that is a transformation and contact division is that we are integrating in long-range precision fires that increases the ability to extend our operational reach. And as many of us have discussed with you all before, it also provides us a platform that we can better protect ourselves with, because we can shoot and then we can rapidly displace or move to an area that affords us better protection. This is not necessarily new across the Army. We have certainly incorporated this capability into previous training events before, like JPMRC last October, or in the Philippines training over the course of the last 2 years. However, what is different about this is now this capability will be organic to the Division Artillery Brigade.
And we are told that the high-mobility rocket launchers are currently being used in Ukraine and are expected to help our soldiers see and strike at a faster rate than their current training allows. While the long-range rockets are not new to the military, they are new to Hawaii.
Generals, where will your troops be training with this new equipment? Will it be at Paakaloa, Kahuku, or Makua?
Catherine, great to hear from you. Generally, over the course of the next several months, the training will be here at Schofield, and it will also be over at Paakaloa. And then, much like we've done in the course of the last 2 years, we plan to train forward beginning in February of 2026 in the region in the Philippines.
That was Major General Robert Evans, commander of the 25th Infantry at Schofield Barracks. He was talking at a briefing this morning. The Army plans to acquire a total of 16 of these launchers. They will have a range of 250 miles compared to the 25 to 40 mile range of howitzer cannons.
In the Netherlands, some teens and young adults are discovering Christianity from their social feeds.
This young generation is like open-minded. They don't have to go to church. They can find everything on social media. So they discover like a new way of being a church.
How Gen Z is reimagining faith and community, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Through Brexit, COVID, and inflation the last few years, we've kept up with a honey shop in London to learn how small businesses there are faring.
I think it's really difficult. We're having to kind of constantly manage an uphill struggle of more and more cost, more and more paperwork, more difficult to hire people.
I'm Amy Scott. The honey business, not so sweet right now. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Hawaiian Electric Company and Huhonua, also known as Honua Ola, very quietly resumed talks to restart the bioenergy plant on the Big Island. In a filing with the Public Utilities Commission last month, the two parties indicated they are negotiating terms of a new power purchasing agreement. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us this morning. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I'm sure this caught lots of people by surprise.
It really did. And, you know, going back, whether or not Huhonua's facility should be allowed to operate has been the subject of debate for really years. But it did kind of seem like the matter was settled when the Public Utilities Commission had rejected HELCO's request to purchase power from Huhonua in 2022, and then that Hawaii Supreme Court decision upheld the commission's decision in 2023. So as I was reaching out to people about this development, that the two parties were back in talks, it was surprising to even people who were like deeply involved in this issue in the past. And one of the people that I talked to was Jennifer Potter, who was actually one of the two commissioners who rejected Huhonua's bid to operate in 2022.
A lot of us within the industry had thought that this issue had been put to rest and that the decision was final after the Supreme Court issued their order in 2023. This was definitely a surprise.
And that decision was based on the emissions, right, and the cost to customers.
So it was based on a couple of things, but those were the two big reasons, right? The plant's climate impact and the cost to ratepayers, as you said. So what we need to know about the plant is it involves biomass. Biomass involves burning organic matter to produce power, and it is considered a renewable resource under state statute. However, the actual process of making electricity does produce greenhouse gases because you're burning things like trees and trees store carbon. And in order to offset those emissions, you have to plant other trees that will then replace the carbon capture potential, which Huhonua has committed to do. But Potter says that there was uncertainty around that commitment.
But it wasn't binding. There was nothing legal about that to state that they would plant exactly that amount of trees that would produce that much amount of sequestration and ultimately offsetting what the emissions were. So that was a big concern.
And Potter also, in talking about this, said, you know, new planted trees, they can't suck up the same amount of carbon emissions in the atmosphere as older trees. So it would take some time for those new trees to offset the climate impact of the plant. And those things led the PUC to worry that Huhonua could become a net emitter of carbon emissions over the course of its operations. And of course, the other sticking point for the PUC at the time was that the plant was expected to displace other cheaper sources of energy, including renewables like wind and solar, and therefore raise customers' bills by about $11 per month for the duration of the time that the plant was operating.
You know, and there have been a lot of changes to the energy landscape since the PUC made this last this decision in 2022. But, you know, what's the feeling now?
Right. So one of the things that we've seen is kind of a loss of federal subsidies and incentives for solar and wind. And I asked Jennifer Potter if she thinks that changes the calculations on whether or not Huhonua has a role to play on Hawaii Island's grid. And this is what she said.
Given the challenges associated with the tariffs and with the reduction and elimination, the future elimination of those tax credits, it is going to be very difficult for solar and wind to participate really cost competitively in the market. We can see that 30% tax credits are significant buy down for these plants. And so if there is another round of competitive bidding, that could certainly impact the prices that we would see come into play. So that could put Huhonua at a very competitive baseline with these other facilities that are coming to play.
She also said she doesn't think that the landscape has changed so much that Huhonua is a silver bullet. And she really says she stands 100% by the decision she made in 2022. So she's going to be looking to see if a new power purchase agreement application addresses any of those concerns that were raised when she was a commissioner over cost and greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, there is a, you know, lot of fretting about our energy resilience, you know, and, you know, if we don't have this, then what?
Right, right. And it'll be interesting to see how the decisions that have been made in the past on this case, even though the circumstances are different, come up again. So the reason we know that Huhonua and Hawaiian Electric are in talks again is because they submitted a joint letter to the Public Utilities Commission via their attorneys that expressed their intent to file a new application for HELCO to purchase power. We don't have that power purchase agreement in hand yet. So there's still questions about what it will entail. And both companies confirmed the negotiations to me, but they declined to provide further details when I reached out to them. And Potter says it does seem like the parties are essentially trying to wipe the slate clean of everything that happened over the last decade.
This is a new commission than what was in place in 2022. And so there's an attempt to restart the process. However, there is precedent. And so the precedent exists within the Supreme Court. It exists within the PUC. And so there is not really a way to just disregard everything that's already been done. So while that may be a hope from the parties in this case, it is unlikely that that can be just a fresh start from the very beginning.
And of course, other people who have been intimately involved in this in the past are not going to let this go. One of them is Henry Curtis. So Henry Curtis leads Life of the Land, an environmental group that actually appealed an earlier commission decision that had approved the biomass plant because they didn't believe that the commission had appropriately accounted for the plant's climate impact. And that's what really got the ball rolling on the last saga of events we saw around Huhonua. And I reached out to Henry Curtis, and he said they're waiting for that power purchase agreement to be filed to determine what their next move is going to be. But he said, and I quote, "Certainly Life of the Land is not going to walk away from this." And there are other new voices who may play more of a role in this conversation this time around, too. One is State Representative Matthias Kusch, who represents the area where the plant is, that community. And he actually toured the facility at Huhonua's invitation last fall after he'd been appointed to his position following the death of Representative Mark Nakashima. But Kusch's first dealings with Huhonua occurred long before that. He actually used to live and run an avocado farm about half a mile down the road from the biomass plant. And he said at the time, Huhonua's operations had raised a number of red flags for him, namely the added traffic from the facility's trucks on the community's narrow roads.
I've had an opinion in the past that was very strong against Huhonua. And as a legislator, I try to keep an open mind, listening to constituents and getting feedback. So with this now entering the news again, that'll be part of my role as a legislator, is to kind of get the temperature.
Yeah, I guess that's all you can ask, right? Open mind and weigh the alternatives.
Yeah, exactly. So he intends to bring it up in community meetings. He also expects to send out questions to his constituents during mailers coming up on this fall. We do expect that a new power purchase agreement could be filed this fall. However, Kusch specifically said he also sits on the Energy and Environmental Protection Committee and the State House, that they've given the Public Utilities Commission a lot to do coming out of this last legislative session. So we might not see this in any immediate fashion.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see if they can address those issues, though, about, you know, emissions and greenhouse gases.
Certainly.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HBR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. A ruling handed down by a Kauai judge yesterday is a blow to a company who wanted to develop a golf course in spite of fears about anthrax buried deep underground. Honolulu Civil Beat's Brittany Light joins us today to talk about the case. Good morning, Brittany.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so this case I know raised a lot of eyebrows because of the anthrax that's buried under this golf course that they want to develop.
It sure does, and you know, the anthrax situation, some people in the community have known about it forever. Other people, it's really news to them. There was an epidemic in 1890 where hundreds of cattle died from anthrax, and again in 1917. So this all happened many, many years ago. But there was an anthrax outbreak. It affected cattle, and the cattle, you know, were killed, and they were buried underneath what later became a, you know, renowned golf course. That golf course is now defunct, and Starwood Capital Group, which owns a luxury hotel in the Princeville community on Kauai, they also own this golf course and had plans to start developing it as soon as next year. But with this judge's ruling, it looks like that may not be happening.
So they were going to tear up this overgrown golf course and put up homes?
Yeah, the latest plan was dozens of luxury homes and condos. There had been a previous plan to put a glamping resort, a luxury camping resort there. The county, you know, let the developer know that that wasn't going to fly with the zoning rules. So the new plan was luxury homes. And two residents who, you know, filed this legal challenge against the developer, they have battled both of these projects. And, you know, on the grounds that this whole anthrax situation is perhaps, you know, they argued more of a public health threat than the developer cared to admit or see.
And, you know, I mean, anthrax is normally found in the environment, but, you know, because they had the problems with the cattle and they, you know, spread so much of that anthrax to help with the decomposition, right? I mean, it's just a little dicey because you don't know, are you going to, you know, dislodge some of the spores up into the air? And that was the concern.
That was the concern. That was the fear. And, you know, different anthrax researchers, scientists have sort of weighed in differently on whether this is really a threat that can't be overcome by just, you know, having the construction workers, you know, be appropriately dressed for this sort of a thing. You know, other experts said, you know, no, this is a real public health concern for everybody in the community. So, you know, the judge basically sided with these residents and said it is a concern. And there's another issue here centering on the Homeowners Association in this Princeville Resort community. You know, its original incorporation papers talked about how the golf course is part of the open space in this area that's sort of a cornerstone of the entire development, and it's envisioned to be there in perpetuity. So that was another layer to this debate, is whether these homeowners association documents are, you know, can really stand up to a legal test. And the judge ruled that, yeah, the golf course was intended to be there forever. People bought homes along the golf course envisioning open space in perpetuity, and that land can only be used for golfing or other ancillary recreation purposes. And so that also is a big reason why the developer lost this case.
Yeah, any word? I mean, are they going to try and appeal it?
No word yet. We haven't heard back from the attorneys for Starwood. It's certainly a possibility, and that does often happen in cases like this. The stakes are pretty high for the developer, we'll just have to wait and see. But right now, this is a big win for, you know, these two community activists who also live in homes right along the golf course. There's a lot of people in that community who I think are cheering this ruling today.
Yeah, a win for open space, green space.
Yeah, a win for open space, and it also really shows the power of these homeowners association documents to sort of stand up to, you know, the courts and to, you know, when a community is built around open space, there's really some weight to that.
Yeah, real fascinating story. But thank you so much, Brittany.
Thanks.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Civil reporter Brittany Light about a court ruling affecting development in Princeville. Read her story at civilbeat.org. Thank you.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaii.
For today's backyard quiz, we're exploring the many uses of a well-known flowering tree found here in Hawaii. It was first domesticated in Southeast Asia. The tree's harvested nuts have found at archaeological sites in Timor, dating back to as far as 1300 BCE. Both the nut and the oil can be extracted from the tree, and both have had many uses in different communities. While the nuts are mildly toxic in the raw, they can be consumed after they're roasted. In the Philippines, the tree has been widely planted to manage property lines because the silvery underleaf makes the tree easy to see from a distance. And in Batak communities, wealthier members are buried in coffins made from the wood from the tree. Fijians use the oil from the tree's nuts to make cosmetic products. And in Tonga, the sweet-scented emollient from the nuts have been used as part of funeral rituals. Here in Hawaii, the nuts were historically burned to provide light and a condiment known as inamona, a common ingredient in poke, is made when paste and salt are added to the nuts once they're roasted. For today's quiz, we want to know, what's the common name of this tree here in the islands? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689. If you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag and a brand new pack of the card game Kumala'au, made by Trees for Honolulu's Future.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nairit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NairitHawaii.com.
You know, we heard from several of you following our recent call-in show about the crackdown on illegal aerial fireworks. Here are some voicemails and letters that you left us.
Gary Harold, calling from Hilo. My comment is this. Fireworks discharge a tremendous amount of carbon into the atmosphere, and we have a climate emergency going on, rising sea levels, frequent and more severe storms, species extinction also. Fireworks discharge debris, washes in the gutters of Hilo into Hilo Bay, and Hilo Bay is already pretty polluted. And we don't need the noise. Cats and dogs run away. They get frightened. So no noise, no fireworks, no more carbon discharging pollution into our atmosphere. Thank you.
And Cheryl in Mililani told us about her July 4th experience. She writes, there was definitely a difference in the amount of fireworks neighbors were shooting off. It was very little compared to last year. We heard a loud boom every 15 minutes, and there were no fireworks being set off the day before or the rest of the weekend. That was the big difference. Before, we heard fireworks days before and after the 4th. We have a dog who is very nervous around loud noises, and while we have a plan leading up to the holiday, it is still very stressful for us. And Mike in Hawaiian Paradise Park thinks that we need to wait to see if illegal fireworks laws are working.
Hi, my name is Mike, and I'm on the Big Island in Hawaiian Paradise Park. We always have a lot of fireworks on New Year's and Chinese New Year's, and I think you should wait to judge the law until then. I hope 4th of July just really isn't celebrated a lot on the Big Island by a lot of people. It's hard to celebrate that day. We're in Hawaii. Let's judge the law on New Year's, yeah? All right. Keep up the good work.
And we thank you for the feedback. If you'd like to add your voice to the conversation, leave us a voicemail at 808-792-8217. Or you can email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
You know what they say, the nose knows.
One of the key functions of the sense of smell is to be able to avoid things that made us sick.
Of the five senses, smell is often ignored by researchers, but it may be the most primal, the most beastly sense, and therefore the one that can tell us more about the world than we consciously understand. The science of smell on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Today on The Daily, what we now know about the missed opportunities that may have contributed to the growing tragedy of the flooding in Texas, and whether anything more could have been done to save lives. I'm Natalie Kitroeff. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Sheng Wang's style has been described as unconventional and reminiscent of the late Mitch Hedberg. Wang's Netflix special, Sweet and Juicy, was named among the best comedy of 2022 by the New York Times. He'll be performing at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center for one night only this weekend. Wang spoke with The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about his influences and how he's inspired by Hawaii. He starts by describing the first time he ever attempted doing stand-up as part of a social club in college.
I remember just being unsure of what I was supposed to be doing. I started talking about my day or talking about the shirt that I was wearing. And I don't know if it was the personality or the awkwardness of it all, but that mirror too was somehow funny to the others that were sitting there. I think it was more the delivery and the presence that I had on stage that was unassuming and awkward and slow, and somehow it worked. But that was just a fun little moment. Most of my life, I was not the class clown. I never sought to be in the spotlight. And it was never a consideration that I would do anything in the entertainment field, really, at least not in front of the camera. So it was just a really electrifying experience, honestly. The times before that, when I found myself on stage, I was like forced to do it. It was out of obligation, whether it was some sort of school event or a summer camp event. But I did notice that even those moments where I was coerced into doing something on stage, when the moment finally came, I did enjoy it. There was some kind of electricity being in front of a crowd of people.
Yeah, and the discovery of that sounds fun. I suppose some people feel like they come out of the womb as like a natural performer or something, but it sounds like in your case, you sort of stumbled into it and discovered this electricity that you experienced once you actually put yourself under the lights.
Yeah. I remember after we decided who was going to do what for the next show, and we did rehearsals, and I started writing jokes, and I started working on putting together a little set, I was just smitten. I was bitten by the bug. I felt it gave me some sense of purpose, something to look forward to, something to promote when I was on campus, and it was really fun. Honestly, the jokes that I told that first time on stage were terrible, mostly copying other people. I didn't even know that many stand-up comedians at the time. I knew there was Chris Rock and Chris Tucker, and I just copied some jokes that they had told. It was not good as far as the writing and material went, but the experience was still really fun, and somehow I got laughs, and it was just the beginning.
Yeah, and I like that you've referenced a couple of times that it may not have necessarily been sort of the punchlines per se or the jokes that you had taken from others, but it was something about the energy and the presence and how you presented. And that seems to me to be a big ingredient of stand-up comedy.
Yeah, when you're doing stand-up, it's pretty minimal. It's usually just you and a microphone and a stage, a brick wall or something behind you, and you have your performance and you have the material that you prepared. And the show is the combination of those two things. And a great show is when you have great performance combined with great writing and material. And when I first started doing stand-up, for me, I'm more of a writer. I believe I'm more keen on honing the material, picking the right words, really approaching the process with the poet's intention, just very intentional, picking the right words and figuring out how to articulate these ideas. And then the performance was an afterthought to a certain extent. Especially at the very beginning, I just pretty much just got drunk and started telling the jokes that I had prepared. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I enjoy doing both. The most satisfying part to me still, though, is writing, is just creating a new idea that wasn't there before or making the current ideas better.
You've said that you prioritize living in the present and that you hope your comedy is generally driven by wonder, exploration, and quote, maybe hope. Talk a little bit more about that. How does that wonder and sense of exploration play out in your life that feeds your comedy?
I love taking walks. I love just looking outside the window. I like engaging with my environments, and I especially enjoy natural environments with trees and flora and fauna. So, for example, I went for a big walk yesterday, and it's something I try to do somewhat regularly. This is just around my neighborhood in LA, and there's a hill, and I just try to take the time to just enjoy everything in my surroundings. Just pay attention and notice what's happening, and be patient and look closely. Take a moment to really appreciate the color, the texture, the patterns of these flowers. Red-tailed hawk that's circling above, that looks beautiful. It's just a way of existing. It's just a way of engaging with real life. It's just using your eyes to pay attention. It's just a way of existing.
It is a way of existing, and a beautiful one at that. And in your case, it seems to lead you back to comedy, because the way you even described that experience, it felt like Mary Oliver poetry or something like that. And yeah. and so you find this outlet for, right, that steers you toward comedy. Somehow seeing that red-winged hawk overhead leads to an idea that goes into a set.
I guess it always starts from a point of wonder. And then the next step is, how do you share this with others? How do you share this with strangers or an audience? And in the context of a comedy show, it's got to elicit a laugh. So how do we bring this moment into that context? Just that hawk example from yesterday, I have an old joke from years ago when I was on tour and I was just driving from town to town doing these college shows. And I remember on the highway, I witnessed a big brown eagle catch a snake on the side of a highway, and it just picked it up and flew off. And I remember being in awe of that moment. And the joke I wrote at the time was, the joke was, I called my friend and I said, hey, I just saw the Mexican flag live in Wisconsin. And because that image of a eagle holding a snake is such a powerful image. And one reference for that is the center of a Mexican flag. There's that image there. And so basically inserting the flag and making it a sort of anthropomorphic object, it's putting on a show for me. And yeah, so it's just finding a way to take those little things that I find so interesting and so beautiful, and just trying to figure out how to share it with people in a way that's funny, surprising.
Yeah, yeah. That's beautiful. That's wonderful. It also reminds me of the novelist and writer Amitava Kumar. He always says, you know, his goal every day is 250 words and a walk. And I love this emphasis you have on getting out there into the world and just observing it and seeing it as a well that you return to.
Absolutely. Just that practice of observing, of going outside and looking around and taking the time to patiently observe. I think taking a walk is the easiest way into that. And then the practice of taking your time and paying attention can also be applied to going inward a little bit and basically learning about yourself and learning who you are and what your thoughts and opinions are about these things around you. And so that definitely comes into play as well. And it's also very important as comedians to know yourself.
Well, and you said you identify first and foremost as a writer, or you feel like a writer at heart. I know you've done writing in other formats. You wrote for ABC's Fresh Off the Boat. And I would assume an experience like that might come with, a stronger sense of rules and strictures in terms of what you can do in a very certain time frame, and maybe more collaborative working with other writers. Talk about the experiences, or the difference in the experience between writing for a show with a staff of writers and crafting your own set.
Sure. I think since I started out in stand-up, and it's the most experience I have, it's what feels most comfortable to me. Even the other kind of pursuits I was interested in doing coming out of college, which were poetry or photography, they're generally, along with stand-up, these are pretty like solo journeys for the most part. In stand-up, basically, you are, it's just you. It's a solo lone wolf kind of path, and you take all the glory with all the failure. It's all on you, one way or the other, and you don't really have anybody to be accountable to, so besides yourself. So it's easy to just make changes and try and experiment and just do whatever you want to do, which is the beauty of it. When you're working in a more like a TV show or a group setting or writer's room like that, it's a different environment, different situation, different dynamics. And especially if you are a staff writer or you're at the very beginning level versus a more experienced executive producer or the showrunner. In that position, for me, it was more about picking and choosing when it makes sense for me to chime in and contribute. But a lot of it for me was, at the time especially, was just learning and listening and seeing how everything worked. It was a bit of a jarring change up for me to go from writing stand-up to writing in the writer's room. But it was also really fun to have other people to bounce ideas off of and to listen to other people's ideas. It's definitely a more collaborative process versus doing stand-up. It's pretty much a conversation with yourself.
Yeah, you're asserting yourself minute by minute. Well, and you've been doing stand-up for a while now, as you said earlier, since the early 2000s. I know you were at the Montreal Comedy Festival back in 2007. That's a lot of time, and I wonder, you know, the context in which a set is crafted and delivered, it seems to me to have changed a bunch in the last couple of decades. But I'd love to get your take on that. I mean, has the art of stand-up changed in the time that you've been doing it, or has your approach to building a set changed?
Not a whole lot. I mean, in terms of my personal process, I think the changes that I could speak to would be just being more comfortable being myself, being more comfortable picking those more seemingly smaller and personal moments to talk about versus discussing topics that are more typical or general to a stand-up show. I don't know if that's a virtue of my growth as a creator or as a person or maybe both. I think earlier on, the jokes might be more stories about being in a bar or talking to girls or things about that would be more fun for a younger person to think and talk about versus now. The topics I talk about now, especially the more fun stuff, is small things in the kitchen, whether it's cooking or avocados or cookie sheets or sinks or spices and herbs and kitchen drawers and stuff like that. These are just like, they're kind of small things in my personal life that I somehow find can connect to an audience at large.
I guess that approach to comedy, so this observational starting point, engaging the world closely around you as you make your way throughout the day, it kind of creates a catalog of where you've been all your life and how you've grown and how you've changed and where your focus is.
Yeah, I think when I was younger, starting out as a comedian, I felt like there was a need for crazy life story, wild experiences, whether it was just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, having some drunken tomfoolery out there. But now I don't think that's that important or that necessary, and that's not the kind of comedy that I'm that interested in doing anymore.
Well, you're bringing your comedy to Hawaii this summer. Have you spent a lot of time in Hawaii previously?
I love going to Hawaii. I think it's got some of the most beautiful natural environments in the world. I think it's just so, it's very tropical, very lush. Some of the most stunning trees I've ever seen are in Hawaii, and they're just there very casually at a park or next to a parking lot, and it's just this big, beautiful wonder, just so casually there. And I'm always blown away by how beautiful it is between the plants and the forests and the mountains and the ocean. It's a wonderful place to explore. I'm just really grateful for all of this. I've been doing stand-up for 20 plus years. This is my first major tour, and it's my first theater tour. And I don't know, I'm just so grateful that like I've gotten to this point in my career where, like we talked about earlier, I feel very comfortable speaking upon these little things in my life that I find so beautiful and exciting. And I'm so excited that people also resonate with this type of material. I generally do a little informal meet and greet after the shows, and it's been just such a wonder to meet these audiences, and it's so sweet and touching and wholesome to me that people resonate with my material in a way that impacts their lives, and they put on like the sweet and juicy Netflix special just for comfort, or they tell me about how this special got them through some really tough times, whether it's a loss in their family or just going through some terrible health issues. Yeah, I just am so grateful that I get to travel and work, do shows for people, and that there's audiences that connect with the material in such a deep and meaningful way.
That was comedian Shen Wang, who spoke with HPR's G.W. Gibson. Wang will be performing at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center this Saturday, July 19th at 7 p.m. For more information about his upcoming show, visit our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And now it's time to crack open the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about a tree known throughout the South Pacific. In Hawaii, the nut from the tree is not only used in candle making and as a key ingredient in inamona for poke, but the nutshells are often incorporated into the lei making, and the nuts are charred to generate ink used by tattoo artists. The red-brown dye made from the inner bark of the tree has been used on kapa and aho, and a coating from the oil extracted from the nut is known to help preserve fishing nets. This tree's role in Hawaiian culture is so prominent, it's the official state tree, not to be confused with the ohia lehua, which was identified as the official Hawaii state endemic tree by the state legislature back in 2022. So, what's this versatile vegetation so prominent in our region? It is commonly referred to as a candle nut tree, but here in Hawaii, we know it as the kukui. And congrats to Mark Kramer from Makaha. You got it right. That's our quiz today. If you have an idea to share, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Reflections in Motion is a ballet event that is scheduled for the Neil Blaisdell Concert Hall later this month. It features students and professional ballerinas who took part in a Ballet Hawaii Summer Intensive. A former student, Courtney Schenberger, is now a principal with the Carolina Ballet. She talked with us about how grateful she is to be able to give back to a dance community that gave her so much.
I feel very fortunate to be in this position, very lucky to be able to give back to everyone in Hawaii. Ballet Hawaii gave me so much. They gave me so many performing opportunities. There's not many schools, even in the mainland, where you're able to have this mixed cast of all of these like top of their game professional dancers and performing with them as a child. I remember being so inspired and like feeling very nervous, but also excited that I was like able to share a stage with them. Yeah, being able to come back and do it is just so incredible.
So do you remember some of the dancers that came through that you were just impressed by?
So Megan Fairchild has been our Sugar Plum Fairy, or Ballet Hawaii Sugar Plum Fairy, ever since I was a child. And she's still coming back, and she's going to be the Sugar Plum Fairy, I believe, this year as well. And she's actually at the intensive, and I get to perform alongside of her, which feels like a real full circle moment where I was the little Clara when she was the Sugar Plum Fairy at around like age 11. And now I'm coming back 18 years later, and I'm getting to perform with her, and she is still at the top of her game. And it is a real, I don't know, incredible thing.
I think this year we heard about Misty Copeland retiring, and that was like, wow, holy cow, she just achieved so much and did so much for the arts. And that was just listening. It was interesting to listen to her interview and her thoughts reflecting on making it in the ballet world. But it's so important, I think, for our young people to see what's possible. And I think the competitions, the YGP, I mean, that I remember taking my daughter to those competitions, and it was such an eye-opener. And when you see the caliber of the dancers from across the country, it's wow.
Yeah, I had the same thing happen to me where I went to YGP, and it was, I remember it in L.A., and I remember feeling in the moment discouraged because I was like, whoa, everyone is so incredible. I didn't realize that this is going to be my competition. And I was still 12 years old. And I remember watching them and being, instead of it letting, you know, it letting me get down, I was like, okay, now I know that there are people like this out here and I have to work even harder. And it actually got my butt into gear. And I remember after that, I was just on hyper-focus mode. And I was like, I really want to do this and I want to be that good. And along with having the professionals come and seeing that, seeing people my own age as well that were just beyond what I thought I could even do at the time.
I remember we had a couple of boys that went on that trip and they were just bowled over. There was a Russian ballet dancer and he was like 12 and they were like, holy cow, we have to catch up to that level.
Yeah.
But one of those boys now is a principal, Costa Allen,
yes,
in Europe. And so
yeah,
it's just so neat to see the Hawaii kids doing so well and making their mark in the dance world.
It is. I think it shows you, like, no matter how many schools are near where you are, and like, it's really just about how hard you work and the people. And honestly, it's really about the community that can support you, which we have such a wonderful one in Hawaii. Everyone is so supportive. And even when I come back, I feel like I've never left.
Tell us about this upcoming performance, because you've been working in a summer intensive with the students there at Ballet Hawaii, and you're going to be able to show what they can do at this event.
All the dancers it's so full of talent, and I love coming and seeing the improvements, because this is my third year coming back and recognizing faces, seeing how much they've grown, and just being able to be a little part of that has been amazing. And yeah, the kids are doing so well. They're rehearsing like crazy for many hours out of their summer. And you'll get to watch them in Cinderella, Reflections, and I believe there's a jazz piece that's being set that they have been working very hard for. But yeah, it's just, I think, I don't know how else to say it other than to be a part of their journey, however small, that is so inspiring because they're the next generation and they're just going to do so much.
I know that these intensive workshops really do help the children, these young dancers, focus aside from just the regular classes that they take after school, you know, and mm-hmm. they may be fortunate enough to take dance at their schools as well. But without mm-hmm. Ballet Hawaii or Hawaii State Ballet, there's just so much talent to be nurtured.
Yes. So much talent. There's so much talent on the islands, and there's just so much talent on the islands, and like, they are such hard workers. No matter how small Hawaii is, they really are a force to be reckoned with.
And I know that some of these workshops can get expensive. There are folks that try out maybe the ABT workshops in the summer or in the spring. It's a commitment, and it can be expensive. I don't know. Are there scholarships out there that students need to know about?
I'm not sure if there's any, like, overall scholarship, but I think auditioning and really putting yourself out there are always scholarships to be had by schools, and I think it's one of those things where the worst thing you can do is to not even try and to really just continue to put yourself out there. Don't be discouraged and talk yourself out of something before you've even really given it a chance. Because I think with scholarships, like, they're always available. You can always find a way as long as you, again, put yourself out there, because most of these major companies have big schools attached to it and there are some sort of endowments for a lot of them. So that's what I would really suggest.
And there are different routes to get to dancing on the stage. Not everybody gets into Juilliard, but folks may go a different path. I know there were kids here who discovered ballet and jazz late in high school and yet went on to mm-hmm. perform on Broadway. And
yeah.
But it's just so neat that when these students come back, or I should say when these dancers come back to teach mm-hmm. the local students, that's it's just so nice.
Yes, it really is. And I think a lot of it goes back to, so the way that I actually found the company that I'm in is that they came and guested for Ballet Hawaii. They brought a lot of their dancers And they did a Romeo and Juliet with us. And I met a lot of my like now coworkers, and though some of them have retired, like my first introduction to Carolina Ballet was through Ballet Hawaii. And though we are hundreds and hundreds of miles apart, the fact that I found where I was going to end up dancing with and become a principal with, or a principal at, was all started here when I was 15, was a pretty crazy thing to think about.
Yeah, it's those connections.
You never know where you'll get exposure and connection. And yeah, I owe Ballet Hawaii everything.
Okay, and then what are the particulars for the performance? Anything else our listeners need to know?
We have two principals, Megan Fairchild and Lucienne from PNB. Or sorry, Megan is from New York City Ballet, Lucienne's from PNB. And they're also going to be doing the Ruby's Paw from Jules. And that's choreographed by George Balanchine. And so that is not to be missed. They will be sparkling in that piece. And yeah, we'll have four pieces in that program. And so I think it'll be a really fun opportunity to see different styles of dance and just different choreography by our talented students.
And I think folks have been waiting patiently because the concert hall has been closed for renovations. And so, yeah, it'd be nice to see the dancers back on stage there again.
Oh, exactly. And I love the concert hall. It's such a beautiful theater. And I'm so happy to be back there.
All right. Thank you so much for your time and good luck with the show.
Thank you so much.
That was Courtney Schoenberger, a principal with the Carolina Ballet, who recently returned home to take part in an intensive workshop with Ballet Hawaii, where she started dancing as a young ballerina. Reflections in Motion runs July 25th and 26th. Look for links on our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about the impact of President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill on Hawaii's healthcare system. Give us feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.